renegade economist is saying, yeah.
Economics for activists. Economics is being made. Economics is not. These are the tools activists need. How can we calculate it? What motivates them? Why do people spend money? Understand the basics to economics.
This week on the show, we talk to Professor Michael Hudson. Michael Hudson is back. Your ears are going to burn. He's talking about the upcoming G20 meeting and austerity for prosperity. That is the key, austerity for prosperity. How's the IMF World Bank got back in the ring? Carl Fitzgerald on the Renegade Economist. Well, we need some cheering because we've got some heavy hitting coming up with Professor Michael Hudson. He's been critiquing the World Bank IMF Washington consensus since the early 70s in his book Super Imperialism. Going to be delivering many, many blows coming up. But firstly, want to put forward that the Renegade Economists are about 65% of the way towards our Radiothon aim. So starting the show a little bit early because we have a piece of the infamous tote carpet. Yes, the tote mosh pit. A portion of it is perfectly cut up and ready for your doorstep. Call the station 94198377. That's 94198377. Or contact us, you podcasters. Come on. renegades@earthsharing.org.au. So yes, we've also got that carpet is from our anti-gentrification festival we're running at the moment. It is lots of fun. We're going to be at the Workers Club this weekend. The Workers Club, check out earthsharing.org.au to find out more about that. So, also, a big event on tomorrow night. Big event. If your brain cells need some massaging, please come along and hear Dr. Gavin Putlin, who's been on the show before. When you've paid your rent, you've paid your way. How would you like the price of goods and services to go down, your income to go up, your rent to go down, and your tax to disappear? Well, that is what we're on about, and that's what Professor Hudson will be discussing right about now. So hopefully you can come to our venue at 1/27 Hardware Lane tomorrow night to see Dr. Gavin Putlin. Free event, massive information to be coming your way. All right, check out michael-hudson.com, michael-hudson.com. We start off the discussion with Professor Hudson talking about what the upcoming G20 meeting is all about coming up in Toronto this week.
It's been orchestrated for the last half year, starting with President Obama's appointment of a commission to balance the budget. The head of the European Central Bank, Claude Trichet, has already said what the theme will be, that the only way to get prosperous is to being poor. He's telling countries, you have to be poorer, you have to cut your wage rates. Latvia is looked at as the ideal that's being recommended for Greece and other countries in budget deficit. Latvia has cut its public sector wages by 30%, and we were told a few weeks ago by the head of the central bank there's only a little bit more to cut to get to the 40% rate. So the theme of the meeting in Ottawa will be that it's time for governments to bring on a artificial depression. The aim is to lower wage rates throughout the world by about 40%. In other words, the game is over, the bubble's over, it's time for the foreclosures now. And there have been a number of sort of truisms that they're going to try to popularize throughout the world. They're basically oxymorons. So the main one is prosperity requires austerity. In other words, the whole world is going to be suffering from the kind of austerity plan that the International Monetary Fund has been pushing on third world countries. Cut back social spending, run a budget surplus, not a deficit, as Latvia has done, shrink the economy, draw the money out of the economy, collapse wages, cut back Social Security, cut back pensions, cut back social spending, cut back educational spending, and in essence, roll the time clock back about a century to what it was like not only before the New Deal in the United States, but before the whole progressive era that was flowering before World War I. There are going to be a number of things that are said in Ottawa that are absolutely the opposite of reality. One is that an independent central bank is the hallmark of democracy. Actually, an independent central bank is the hallmark of oligarchy. Now that planning is being centralized in the hands of the central bankers, which are the lobbyists for the commercial bankers, you have planning passing out of the hands of elected government people into the hands of unelected bankers. And the problem is that the financial time frame for planning is very short term. It's hit and run. It's make a quick hit, leave the customer with holding an empty bag, and when a banker sees a customer come in, the first thought is, how much does the person have, and how can we get it out of his pocket into ours? This is the kind of planning that the world is going to have for the next few years. And another mythology people are told is that the reason that governments have to balance their budget is governments are just like families. They have to balance the budget and not run into debt. What they don't realize is that central banks were formed precisely to fund the government debt. For the last half century, economic students all over the world have been told that when an economy is going into a recession, when there's a collapse of the world economies, governments have to run a budget deficit in order to supply the purchasing power, supply the liquidity to keep the governments going. But right now, even though there's a recession or the Great Depression number two, governments are being told, don't support wages, don't support spending, don't slow the decline, accelerate the decline by sucking even more money out of the economy.
During the Great Depression times, there were similar pushes, weren't there, for public spending to be wound right back at the very beginning of the Great Depression. Why aren't we learning anything from this?
Because the lessons that normally would be taught are excluded from the economics curriculum. Essentially, what calls itself free market economics is pro-financial economics. It's economics subsidized by the financial sector. And in the United States, that's called the Chicago School. In other countries, it's called monetarism or simply neoliberalism now. And what the neoliberal free marketers realize is that in order to have what they call a free market, you have to have a totalitarian control of government, control of media, and control of the educational system. If you don't have total control of the educational system to exclude the economic history of the 1930s, to exclude classical economics, to keep out any idea but your own, then people are going to adopt these better ideas and not yours. So you've had the economics profession stripped of everything that people used to learn when I went to graduate school to get my degree 50 years ago.
And so this battleground that's continually drawn around scarcity and scarcity rents. Just in the last few hours, Belarus and Russia are having another stoush over their pipeline access rights for gas and the price Russia charges in return for that gas to Belarus. How can societies, neighboring communities, live together in sharing these scarcity rents?
You usually have international relations as power relations. The problem with Belarus and Russia was that Belarus used to be the very heart of Russia. Minsk, for instance, is in Belarus. Just like the Ukraine used to be the original Russia area. Now, the United States neoliberals came in the 1990 and convinced Yeltsin to break up the Soviet Union. So now they're different countries. And now Russia is saying, well, why we're a government that's supporting Russians. Why should we give you the free lunch from the fact that we're lucky enough to be sitting on a huge gas reserve? You're going to have to pay the world price like any other nation, unless you decide you want to be part of Russia. And that, in that case, you get gas at the same price that we get in our nation. If you're going to be a different nation, you have to pay what all the other countries have to pay. You're either with us or you're not.
As we're at this point of peak everything, peak oil and companies having to drill in deeper and deeper water spaces, we've got Belarus and Russia competing there. In Australia, there's a huge mining tax debate going on over how much of the share of the Commonwealth the people should get versus the billionaires. Amazing scenes, Michael. You wouldn't believe these protests with billionaires out in the streets. It seems that the future of economics is going to see more and more focus on the easy profits that resources and their scarcity deliver. What are you foreseeing in this current environment where so many economists have been dumbed down and have not been taught these essential principles?
I think the key isn't really resources today so much as finance. The attempt is going to be to grab resources, not militarily, as was done in the past, but financially. So the new form of international attack, exploitation, and extraction of tribute is going to be done financially, not militarily, and the financially oriented power grab is politicizing itself very much through the Group of 20 that's meeting in Canada, through the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, through what here is called the Washington Consensus, the idea that the rest of the world exists to supply all of its surplus to the United States. And as long as other countries, from England to Australia to Europe, believe that their role is to turn over their surplus to the United States, and specifically to bankers in the United States, you're going to have that overwhelm the whole issue of natural resources.
But surely people such as the Chinese and the radicals in Iceland and places like that, they're not going to believe that. They're going to think that if they own resources, they can earn good hard cash from that, and that gives them a competitive advantage where they have their own income streams and they don't so much need the banking sector. I would have thought that resources are still a very important role in this ever-expanding economy we live within.
What you're saying was what everybody believed a century ago, and it seems a natural way of doing things. There's nothing natural about finance being more important than resources. You'd think that the whole world is constrained by who has the land, who has the natural resources. You think that it would be crazy, indeed, for Iceland to give away all of its power without getting really any tax revenues to the aluminum companies that are refining aluminum there. And if you thought that, you'd be wrong, because they do give away everything for nothing. The fact is that the primary premise that's taught in every economics book and every political science book is wrong. And that premise is nations act in their own self-interest or the interest of their people under democracy. And number two, that in a democracy, voters are going to vote for their self-interest. Now, if voters really voted for self-interest and elected officials that acted in the national interest to help the voters, then the world would not be the way it is. So the question is, why? How did the world get this way, where countries and populations are not voting their self-interest, where they seem to be voting for the interest of other countries and for bankers, and for a kind of a economic dynamic that's exactly the opposite that they believe in? Most people believe the world should be more equal, as you're indicating. Most people say that everyone should have the same opportunity. But the society we're in is just the opposite, where society is getting more and more unequal, where wealth is polarizing between creditors and debtors, and between creditor countries and debtor countries. And how can you possibly explain all of this? This should be what economics really is all about. How to explain why the world is diverging from what you'd think it's supposed to be. And yet there's that topic doesn't even come up in economic studies.
You've just visited Eastern Europe and Latvia in particular, and over the last 24 hours it's broken that Iceland is announcing a safe zone, a safe haven for whistleblowers and in particular for journalists there. It seems like Eastern Europe is becoming more radicalized. Are the people waking up?
No. Iceland is called the most Soviet of all of the Western economies, but that's because it's so bureaucratic and centralized and kleptocratic. And there's a feeling of floundering in Iceland. The reason that WikiLeaks is sponsored in Iceland is because the whole country let itself essentially be robbed by a small group of kleptocrats working with old Soviet Russian kleptocrats. And they wanted to expose all of the loans and the banking frauds that bankrupted the country. So there's a reason for that, and quite apart from its Scandinavian origin. But in Eastern Europe, that's quite a different situation. The people are not voting for their self-interest there. All of the governments of the Baltics and the other Central European economies are the most unequal of all in Europe. And they're unequal because the neoliberals who are running these economies keep saying they give them a false choice. They say your choice is either to go back to the Soviet era and subordination to Russia, or the West. And, of course, the West that they're told about isn't the kind of West that they expected, Western prosperity, social democracy, labor parties. It's becoming a colony of Western Europe, a banking colony, a real estate colony, a financial colony, and a market for surplus agricultural crop surpluses and other goods. So the Eastern Europeans are being given a choice, either go back to Russia and be exploited Soviet style, or join Europe and be exploited Western style. And the populations keep remembering how awful it was under Russian Soviet domination, and they'll choose anything except that, and they're not being given another choice.
Is there any hope for the Latvians? I've heard from you that the main opposition party in Latvia is thinking about some radical economic reform.
Yes, the current neoliberal government in power there says that the way to become more competitive and prosperous in Latvia is to be poor. They cut wages by 40% on the theory that if you cut wages and the cost of labor, you'll be more competitive. Now, in one sense, this is true. But in Latvia, you have the most unequal tax system in the entire world. You have taxes on labor, on wage labor, of over 50%. And you have taxes on property of 0.1%. It's gone up to 1% in some cases. But you have almost no tax on real estate and on land, and an enormous tax on labor. What we're suggesting, a group of experts that came, including two Australians, Terry and Debbie Dwyer, Australian lawyers, we worked out a plan saying, look, you can cut the cost of Latvian labor to its employers by 50%. You can cut it in half without reducing living standards. And you can do that by shifting the taxes off labor, off this terrible flat tax on labor of over 50%, onto the land. And if you tax the land and real estate and natural monopolies, the telephone company, the companies that have been turned over to Russian and domestic kleptocrats, then you will bring down the price. Because if you tax the land, use the land's rental income as the tax base, then this income will not be capitalized into a bank loan and pushed way up in price. So you'll lower the cost of housing to Latvians. At the same time, you maximize their take-home wage as a proportion of the cost of labor to the employers. So this is the program that we're coming out with in the Reform Latvia Task Force. And the election is scheduled for October 2nd. And so the Latvian people can vote for the Harmony Center. And if they come in, they're going to have a third option. They're going to say, look, the option isn't between going back to Russia, which nobody wants to do, or becoming a colony of Europe on conditions of a flat tax and lower living standards. We can. The third option is a tax shift off labor onto land to bring down the cost of housing, to regulate the price of natural monopolies and basic infrastructure, telephone service, transport service. That's how you make an economy more competitive, and of course, that's the real liberalism of Adam Smith, John Stuart Mill, and the other classical economists.
We're talking to Professor Michael Hudson. And Michael, you mentioned natural monopolies there. How should they be paying their fair share of rent? How is that calculated?
There are two ways. When you talk about economic rent, what that is the excess of price over the basic cost of production. Now, a monopoly right has no cost of production. It's a legal right to charge whatever the phone company wants to charge, or the airline company, or the airport, or the gas or power company, or for land. It's what the market will bear. But if the monopolies are kept in the public domain, as they were throughout most of the world until 1980, the purpose of public investment isn't to extract a rent. A public infrastructure should be operated to minimize the cost of living and cost of doing business to the economy at large. This is the basic principle that underlay American economic development prior to World War I. This was the original business plan of the United States. Have the government develop the Erie Canal, the Cumberland Roads, the post office, the basic infrastructure monopolies, and supply these services to the population either at cost or, much better, at a subsidized rate to hold down the national structure. And that's how America managed to outcompete England, that left land and other natural resources and natural monopolies in private hands to be used to extract a rent. And rent is part of price, and if you have a privatization move, which has occurred throughout the world since 1980, then you're going to have these natural monopolies run for profit. And it's not really a profit in the economic sense of the world. It's economic rent, which means it's however much the owner of a monopoly can extract by putting a toll booth on it. For instance, you can have a road that everybody can use for nothing. But if you then say, well, the government wants to cut taxes on the wealthy people, if we cut taxes on the wealthy people, we'll have to make up the money somewhere else. Let's sell the right to put a toll booth on the road. So you sell the toll booth rights to somebody who buys the roads. Your roads are turned into toll roads. All of a sudden, the cost of traveling from one place to another increases. You can sell the national telephone system, as they did in Latvia. Hardly anybody uses a cell phone or a telephone in Latvia because it costs so much to use it. They use Skype, and everywhere you go, people are yelling into their computer and being in a bad mood from trying to use Skype. You have essentially maximized the cost of living and doing business by privatizing the economy, and people think that all this is creating wealth, and it's really extracting wealth. It's not creating it at all. We're brought back to the classical distinction between rent and profit that underlay all of classical economic thought, from the physiocrats to Adam Smith, John Stuart Mill, down to Marx and the socialists in the progressive era. So you're having an inversion of what people thought are supposed to be economic progress and social equity by excluding from the economics curriculum a whole knowledge of what classical economics was all about. Now, the classical liberals were reformers. They wanted to get rid of the free lunch. They wanted to get rid of the hereditary aristocracy that Europe and its colonies had inherited from the feudal medieval period, to get rid of the banks for profit and make credit, which is also a monopoly, the right to just create bank credit. If the government did it, the government would not charge extortionate rates on credit cards or debt cards or extortionate interest rates. The government would supply credit that you needed for doing business and for living, but it wouldn't do what the commercial banks do, and that's just load the economy down with interest-bearing debt to absorb the economic surplus financially. So what you're having today is what would have been considered a dystopia to people a century ago, and people are not even told the world used to be quite different, and it doesn't have to be the way it is.
In the last week or two, the World Bank's been churning out reports telling us how it's going to be the developing world that is going to pull us out of this global recession. It is Asia. They're the ones coming through with the huge growth rates, Taiwan, Hong Kong, China. How are you perceiving that in light of China's overnight devaluation of the yuan?
They're not really revaluing very much. The World Bank is basically an arm of the U.S. government, which means an arm of the U.S. military and the banking system. And for the World Bank, the question of China and the Third World is, how can we get all this money to pay U.S. bankers, not the Chinese? In other words, how can we extract wealth from China? How can we keep the Chinese people as poor as possible and as beaten down as possible so we get to grab all the wealth for ourselves? That's the problem put before the World Bank, just as in the case of Australia. The job of your government is how can we keep the Australian people poor enough so that we can give all the surplus to England and the United States? That's how you become a politician in Australia. Well, that's the same thing they're trying to do in China. Somebody in the Pentagon will think, well, do we have to kill anybody to get them out of the way? How do we get our people in so the Chinas run for the benefit of America, not for the Chinese? And that's what the World Bank is for, to give them a junk economics, to have them act against their self-interest, and to try to force them as much as possible by peer pressure, if possible, otherwise military force, otherwise the targeted assassinations that have become the new peaceful policy under President Obama. How can we just essentially reduce the whole world to feudalism, to debt peonage? What we're seeing today is an attempt to push the world economy back into feudalism, back into a power grab. And unlike the medieval feudal epoch in Europe, it's not being done by armies, it's being done by the banks, and it's being done financially. How can we load an economy down with debt so that people will have to go into debt for their whole life to buy a house and pay all of their earnings as mortgage interest to the banks? How can we have governments essentially untax wealthy people, untax finance, untax property, and get rid of social spending so all the government surplus can be paid to other governments, preferably through foreign debt? That really is the agenda of the World Bank and the other Washington consensus institutions in today's world, as I've written in my book, Super Imperialism.
Michael, the Chinese aren't silly, though. They're going to be seeing what America's up to, and they must be wondering what on earth to do with their surplus dollars. They've bought into the euro, and they've been done over with the deflating euro value. So why are they going to be looking at exporting as a way forward in the future? Will they perhaps look at an isolationist-type model to build up their economy?
This is what I'm urging and what a lot of other people are urging. When China tried a year ago to begin diversifying its foreign exchange reserves out of the dollar, what did it do? It bought euros, and now the euro is collapsing. So the answer is, in today's world, all of the national paper currencies are a bad bet. There's no safety. Money is no longer gold bullion, unless you're an Arab country and they've been buying up gold for their central banks. So in today's world, what is the point of exporting if all you're getting is paper IOUs from a foreign government and the IOUs are going down in value? Isn't it better to use all of this productive power and to supply your own labor force with increasing living standards? So that's the real issue in China that they have today. They're going how to make a transition from an export-oriented open economy to a closed economy where China's productive power is used to upgrade the living standards for Chinese even more. Now, obviously, living standards have been rising very steadily in China. I mean, when I went to China last year from the United States, I felt that I was stepping into the future. Their trains are far ahead of the United States. Their highways, their buildings, already they're making a lot of progress. And now the question for them is, how can they really decouple from the Western economies that are all going down?
Well, that is the big question, isn't it, that we're all looking at. So what are you seeing is going to unfold for the rest of 2010?
More poverty. All of the governments of the G20 meeting in Canada next week are saying we've got to cut back social spending. Even though we're going into economic shrinkage, we've got to shrink social spending all the more. We've got to lower public sector wages in order to bring down private sector wages. And at a certain point, the central banks are going to begin raising the interest rates, which will crash property prices all the more. So it's being sort of staged out so the financial sector can make a killing on the way up while the bubble's being inflated, and another killing on the way down when everything becomes a property grab through foreclosure. It's not going to be pretty.
Do you think that Australia's Treasurer Wayne Swan, having announced the drive to capture some of these resource rents through the mining tax, is going to be befriended at the G20, looked upon as a leader, or will he be pushed into the background?
The G20 believes that all of the gains from mining should go to the financial sector, not to the government. So they're going to say, don't tax it, let it all be paid as interest. The economic surplus in today's world, the choice is either you get the surplus paid to the banks or to the government. And the choice of the G20, which is run basically by the central banks, by the European Central Bank in particular, is going to be, well, the bank should get the money, not the government. So there's a power grab over who is going to run society. Will it be government or the banks? And right now it looks like the financial sector is winning.
That is Professor Michael Hudson. Check out michael-hudson.com. A killer interview up there with Guns and Butter and Bonnie Faulkner there did the other day. So please check out Michael Hudson's work. Check out prosper.org.au to read about tomorrow night's event. When you've paid your rent, you've paid your way.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online.